We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Plenty to talk about again.
Again. Yeah, that keeps happening for some odd reason.
Yeah. So starting out with local, and it looks promising for the passing of a millionaire's tax.
Yeah, well, we've talked on this show quite a bit over the years about the need to reform Washington State's extremely regressive tax structure. And, of course, we got one example of why that's necessary with the budget deal in Olympia a couple weeks ago, where property taxes for homeowners and property owners in Puget Sound especially are going to go way, way up because there really were very few mechanisms available for raising taxes and raising revenue for the state. We're getting another approach from Seattle City Council, which passed out of committee by a 9-0 vote this past week, something originally proposed by Shama Sawant several years ago. We'll get back to that in a moment. This particular ordinance proposed by Lisa Herbolt with the goal that it would be passed out of council by July 10th, and it looks like that's going to happen. The final vote will be on Monday for a progressive income tax on high earners in the city of Seattle. Now, this would be tax of 2% on any income over $250,000 for an individual or $500,000 for a couple. Which is a relatively small tax compared to the income taxes. I was amused to see Steve Ballmer come out against this and say, well, the tech industry is going to be a disadvantage here because the lack of an income tax is a big competitive advantage compared to tech firms in California. Well, aside from the fact that California is doing quite well, the income tax there is 14%, which is much, much higher than what we're talking about here. But this would raise quite a bit of needed revenue for the city of Seattle. And it looks like that's finally going to pass this coming Monday. We will see. The council will be voting on it. I believe 12:30. We'll talk about it in events at the end of the show.
And that's the first step because you know that's going to be challenged in court almost immediately after it passes.
Well, there's two issues. One is the court challenge. The other, and we've seen this in a number of other states, and we've seen it threatened in Washington State, is the Republicans in the legislature are talking about passing state legislation that would preempt local jurisdictions from having a tax like this. And this is a ALEC-type legislation that's been used on a number of different issues in different states where democratically controlled large urban centers are essentially preempted by the state legislatures, which are controlled by more rural Republican legislators. So that also is a threat. And by the way, Shama Sawant, when she originally ran for city council 4 years ago, she ran basically on three ideas, all of which were considered, you know, not only radical, but impossible by most mainstream political commentators. They're not going to happen in a million years in the city of Seattle. One of those was a $15 minimum wage. One of those was a millionaire's tax. And one of those is rent control. And she is now two for three. After 4 years on council. And rent control has got a lot more support in the city of Seattle now than it did 4 years ago. So remarkably effective on her part in changing, not only in changing the discussion on those issues, but on being prescient and understanding that those were going to become more, not less, popular and necessary as time went on. Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. Dow Constantine talking about a potential deadline for Charlena Lyles inquest.
Yeah. Dow Constantine, as King County executive, is responsible for ordering an inquest in the case of an on-duty law enforcement death. That happens in most such cases, and he has also been pushing in recent months to speed up the process of those inquests. The deadline for announcing an inquest for Charlena Lyles, who was killed June 18th, is coming up in the next few days. He has not announced anything as of yet, but is expected to do so. But that inquest process is very limited. There's only been one case out of the hundreds since King County adopted the system in the early 70s where a police officer killing was found to be not justified. That was John T. Williams in 2010. Every other case of use of lethal force by a law enforcement officer has been found to be justified. And while there are people testifying under oath in this case, there's a number of limitations. People can't be cross-examined, for example, if a police officer says something on the stand that that a defense attorney wants to contest, he can't call other witnesses to try and contest or contradict it. There's no provision for
it's not a trial.
It's not a trial at all. There's no representation available for people who can't afford an attorney on their own. You know, all of these different limitations. So, you know, a lot of families of people who've been killed in the past have found the process to be very frustrating and not nearly as helpful as if there were an actual trial. It does put things on the record for a possible civil lawsuit, but that's about it. So we'll see whether that comes to fruition in the next few days, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it more in the future.
All right. Related to that, a new initiative, I-940?
Yeah, a new statewide initiative was launched this week for Initiative 940 that would require police to get mental health training and training in de-escalation tactics. It would also change the wording of state law to make it easier to prosecute police who use deadly force on the job. I-940 would replace the current wording that says a police officer can't be convicted if he or she acted in good faith and without malice. That's a very hard thing for a prosecutor to prove, and one that usually relies on the officer's own statement of intent. And how do you contradict that? I-940 would replace that with a more detailed criteria that looks at what a reasonable officer would have done under the circumstances. Now, it would also require independent investigations of police killings in every instance, not just when police chief decides that's necessary.
So for example, SPD investigating the Sherlina Lyles killing, that would have been farmed out to a different agency.
To a different agency or a different group. And it would require that police provide first aid when they shoot or otherwise injure someone, which is often a complaint by families of the victim that the police shot him and then did not do anything to stop the bleeding. Organizers will need to get 259,000 signatures by the end of the year. If they submit it to the state legislature, you can go two routes with initiative, either go directly to the ballot or submit the initiative to the state legislature. If they submit it to the legislature, then the legislature in Olympia in the next session will have the opportunity to do one of three things, either approve it as it is, approve it with changes, or reject it. If they reject it, it would go to voters at the next election. If they approve it with changes, then both the original version and the legislature's amended version would go to voters at the next election. But first, of course, organizers have to get enough signatures. And organizers said that they'd use a combination of volunteers and paid signature gatherers, which means that they're also going to need donations. Now, the group that is sponsoring that initiative is called De-Escalate Washington, and their website has the same name. So if you have an urge to volunteer to do signature gathering or to donate, that's where you can find them.
All right. Moving on, another initiative, I-1552.
Yeah, and good news here. We have a remarkable number of good news items this week. It's kind of bewildering. But yes, I-1552, which is the Republicans' second attempt in 2 years to pass an initiative, not Republican Party per se, but conservative activists trying to legislate discrimination against trans people and their use of bathrooms. This is something that spawned a very aggressive decline to sign campaign, and that aggressive no campaign paid off. The Secretary of State's office deadline for submitting those signatures for I-1552 was yesterday on Friday, and the sponsors of 1552 canceled their press conference and did not submit their signatures because they apparently did not have enough. So that is dead for this year once again. And trans folks can breathe and their allies can breathe a sigh of relief, although it's quite possible it'll come back from the dead once again next year. But at least for the time being, that is not going to be on the ballot and it is not going to become Washington law.
All right.
Which is good.
Mm-hmm. Also this week, Governor Inslee issues a veto.
Yeah, as part of last week's last-minute state legislative session, the Republicans snuck a huge tax cut bill in just under the wire, It would have been a 40% B&O business and occupation tax cut for all manufacturers in the state of Washington, essentially extending to all manufacturers the same huge tax cut that legislators gave to Boeing in 2013. Now, the tax cut would have reduced taxes for about 10,000 businesses in the state of Washington, leading to a loss of up to $86 million per year by the year 2027. The Republican bill included a total of 13 different tax breaks. Most of them were small ones, but this was the centerpiece, and Governor Inslee vetoed it after 23 Democratic lawmakers, some of whom initially voted for the entire bill, wrote him a letter asking him to veto this tax cut in particular. Republicans immediately pushed back, saying that they would refuse to agree on a deal for funding the state's capital budget, which is still in gridlock. The capital budget, just to remind folks, is the part of the budget that funds the state's construction projects, like roads and bridges and other infrastructure. Now, apparently, the Republicans had tried to insert this tax cut into the budget bill twice, but Democrats had said, no way, that's a step too far. When both sides finally reached an agreement on the budget, they also agreed to an additional Republican bill with a bunch of these small tax cuts in it. And at the last minute, Republicans snuck this huge tax cut into the center of that tax cut bill, and that really miffed Democrats. So when they voted for that bill and found out what was actually in it, it led to them sending a letter to the governor saying, you need to veto this huge tax cut that Republicans snuck in at the last minute. Of course, the governor's not a Republican, so it's something that the Republicans have to learn, is that if you sneak these things in at the last minute, you got to expect the Democratic governor of the state of Washington, who has the right to line item veto, to veto these things. And that's exactly what happened this week. To override that veto would require a two-thirds majority in both houses, which is not going to happen.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Moving on to paid family leave.
Yeah, funding for Washington's paid family leave law. We've actually had a paid family leave law on the books in this state since 2007.
And that was passed by initiative originally, as
yeah,
I recall.
It would, the paid family leave law was supposed to provide all workers in the state of Washington with 12 weeks of paid family leave. But since we've never had any funding mechanism for it, the state legislature has never passed anything, and there's never been anything set up for it. It's just kind of sat there, not actually going into effect. But this year, the law will finally go into effect starting in 2020. All employers in the state will deduct a small amount of tax from their workers' weekly paycheck to pay into a state fund. For example, a minimum wage worker will pay about $1.36 per week from their paycheck into the fund. Employers with more than 50 employees will also pay into the fund, although at a lower rate per worker. Self-employed workers will also be eligible to pay into the fund and receive benefits if they need to take maternity or paternity leave or extended sick leave or leave to care for sick relatives. It won't pay 100% of your income, but it'll pay something. And that's better than nothing, which is what we have had in the past. For minimum wage folks and other low wage workers, it can pay up to 90% of their wages, which is a godsend when you have to take a lot of time off to have a child or to care for a sick relative, or if you have an injury or some other sickness that requires extended medical leave. And Washington now joins four other states in providing paid family leaves, although ours is probably the most generous benefit. The other four states are California, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and New York.
All right. Moving on to national and the White House reaching out and touching all the states for their electoral.
Yeah, well, we talked about this last week, where the commission that Donald Trump set up to investigate the massive voter fraud that he thinks occurred in last year's presidential election, and named to head that commission Kris Kobach, the state of Secretary of State for the state of Kansas, who has been a national Republican leader in championing voter suppression under the name of non-existent voter fraud. He sent out a letter to the 50 states last week, which surprised a lot of people, that asked for a remarkable amount of detailed information information on from each state on all of their voters, namely their voter registration, who was voter, the last four of their social, what their voting history is,
their birthday, their criminal history,
identifying, et cetera. And so far, depending on how you count, up to 45 states have refused to cooperate with this for all the obvious reasons,
including Kobach.
Yeah, including the state of Kansas.
As soon as he sent out the letter, he looked at the regulations in his own state and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, my own state can't comply with this."
Yes, and so a number of states have been competing in their responses to show which can be the most adamant in their refusals. So that's been kind of amusing. But a couple of other things came up about that this week. One of them was we found out what the White House wants to do with all that centralized information, aside from turning it over to the Russians, because it would be pretty much a one-stop shop for Russian hacking. They wouldn't have to go to all these county and state voter registration systems if they can just go to the website and or to the White House. And what we found is that all this would reside on some laptop somewhere administered by a staffer in Vice President Mike Pence's office. I feel better already. the other thing that we learned about this was that the order was probably illegal because of the failure to submit the request to the different states through the Office of Management and Budget's Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Now, that office handles all of these sorts of requests because of a 1980 law known as the Paperwork Reduction Act. Not only was the request a huge overreach, and not only was it done for reasons that ought to alarm anybody concerned about privacy and concerned about protection of the vote, but it was also done incompetently because they didn't know the law.
What a surprise.
What a surprise. But there is every indication that this is an attempt by the White House to orchestrate national voter registration purges and national suppression of the vote, which is an issue that for all the amusement people are getting out of this ham-fisted attempt, that is a very serious and very alarming abuse of power, basically, by the Trump administration.
Which has been very successful at the state levels.
It's been extremely successful at the state levels, but only in states that are controlled by Republican governors and Republican legislatures. This would extend it through the feds to the entire country, which is what they're after.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education.
Yeah, this week, 18 states and the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit in federal court this week against the Department of Education and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos for freezing new rules on forgiving student loan debts for students who were defrauded by private universities. The laws were proposed.
Like Trump U.
Exactly. The laws were proposed after the collapse of two giant private universities, Corinthian Colleges and ITT Technical Institute. Corinthian's closure, for example, led to the federal government, that is, you know, taxpayers like you and me, taking over and forgiving 15,000 student loans totaling $247 million. But an estimated 80,000 former Corinthian students faced some kind of debt collection after the company's collapse, and many of those students were left without a degree of any kind. So the new rules proposed by the Department of Education under the Obama administration would have shifted at least some of the financial burden onto the private education industry, requiring colleges that are at risk of closing to put up financial collateral to cover student loan defaults. The rules would also ban universities from forcing students to sign agreements that force them to give up their right to sue and accept arbitration instead. When DeVos took office earlier this year, one of the first things she did was put a freeze on those rules, which were set to take effect July 1st. Now, the rules had gone through years of negotiation and were finalized last October, but DeVos decided to scrap them and start from scratch, but she has yet to propose any kind of replacement rules. Now, the states are essentially saying that she should put the interests of students ahead of the private education industry, even though she's made a ton of money by investing in private education companies, which is an egregious, and I repeat that, an egregious conflict of interest, something that we're seeing throughout the Trump administration.
And on that score, the offices charged with investigating complaints about egregious conflicts of interest in the Trump administration is the Office of Government Ethics. And the Office of Government Ethics, in the 6 months around the first term for Barack Obama, received about 700 complaints or inquiries on potential conflicts of interest. For the Trump administration's same period of time, it's been 39,000. And this week, the director of the Office of Government Ethics, Walter Schaub, resigned, and he resigned saying very publicly that Donald Trump himself, the president alone, has such egregious conflicts of interest that existing government ethics laws are inadequate for dealing with Trump and his family and their private business interests, let alone all the different, often very wealthy and very conflicted people that Trump has named to cabinet and sub-cabinet positions. Now, that office has had no kind of staffing increases to deal with the massive increase in instances that it's had to investigate, and now it doesn't have a director, and it will be an open question as to whether even Trump even appoints a replacement, let alone who that replacement might be.
Yeah, you'd imagine there's probably a lot of franchise opportunity there with that particular office.
Yeah, potential for conflict of interest there too.
Oh, yes.
All right. Two big court decisions this week.
Yeah. First, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia ruled that the EPA can't suspend the new rule to restrict methane emissions from new oil and gas wells. The Obama administration rule was one of the first rules that EPA Director Scott Pruitt sought to delay when he took office earlier this year.
I'm seeing a theme here.
Yes. First, he imposed a 90-day freeze. Then he extended that freeze to 2 years. But the court said that the EPA didn't have the authority under the Clean Air Act to block the rule once it had already finalized it. In order to reverse the rule, the EPA would have to undertake a whole new rulemaking process, according to the court. In the meantime, the rule should be allowed to go into effect as is. This is the first of many court rulings that we can expect in the coming months on Trump administration efforts to delay or block rules issued by earlier administrations, particularly the Obama administration. The courts are going to be forcing the Trump administration to adhere to the rulemaking process set out by federal government law. So that's good news, and thank God for the courts. Now, the second court decision was in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, which ruled that undocumented children detained by the federal government are entitled to bond hearings before immigration judges. Now, the court's ruling affirmed the Flores Settlement, a 1997 legal case that established rules for how undocumented children should be treated when in custody of the federal government. In addition, the court upheld a decision by federal district judge Dolly M. Gee that said that undocumented children can't be held in prison-like conditions indefinitely. While awaiting a hearing, they must be released to their parents, a relative, or foster parents, if at all possible. But, you know, some still remain in detentions, some for months or even years at a time, during which they're denied any education or any semblance of a family life. The judges agreed that this is inhuman and must be stopped.
Didn't we have another appeals court hearing? I think it was the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, mm-hmm. had a similar ruling a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
ruling. And that has not been implemented either.
Yes, and lawyers for the Department of Justice are expected to appeal this decision to the Supreme Court. The Trump administration is fighting this tooth and nail. Meanwhile, John F. Kelly, the Trump administration's Homeland Security Secretary, has announced that the federal government will start arresting the parents of undocumented children who are smuggled across the border. They will be charged with paying coyotes, or in Kelly's words, human traffickers, to transport their children. They'll be prosecuted under statutes designed to fight human trafficking. But I want to point out that the UN defines human trafficking as involving elements of fraud, threat of force, or coercion in transporting people, with the purpose being to exploit them at the endpoint, for example, selling them into prostitution, forced labor or slavery, forcing them to become child soldiers, or selling them for organ harvesting. None of these elements, I repeat, none of these elements are involved in the cases that the Trump administration will be bringing against the parents of undocumented children. I think that once again, it'll be thank God for the courts. But in the meantime, the fact that parents are being arrested means that many children will cross the border and their parents will not be able to pick them up.
All right. Moving on to international and the G20 meeting.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on internationally. I'm not going to spend too much time on G20 since it's being covered widely. We had, of course, the first meeting between Trump and his boss, Russian President Vladimir Putin, yesterday. And the Russian state news and the Trump administration giving very conflicting accounts as to whether whether Trump pressed Putin on election fraud committed by Russia. Meddling in the U.S. elections last year. According to Russian state media, Putin had said Russia had nothing to do with it, and Trump accepted that. And Rex Tillerson, who is the only other person from the U.S. in the room aside from Trump and a translator, said the opposite, that Trump had been very insistent on it and left out any assurances Trump gave to Putin. The problem is, of course, that both Trump and Putin are known to lie frequently and well. So it's really kind of hard to tell who, if either of them, is telling the truth on this one. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Russia came to an agreement, which was announced in the wake of the Trump-Putin meeting, for a ceasefire to go into effect Sunday in southeastern Syria, an area of Syria where there's been a lot of heavy fighting between the Syrian government and U.S.-backed Syrian rebels, and those areas also are near the borders with U.S. allies Israel and Jordan, which also participated in this ceasefire. There is no agreement yet on another ceasefire that U.S. and Russia had hoped to announce involving what are called de-escalation zones that had been established earlier this year in an agreement that was reached by Russia, Turkey, and Iran because of Iran's participation in that. The U.S. refused to participate, and efforts to get them to get the U.S. and the Trump administration to be involved in a ceasefire in those zones were unsuccessful this time as well. Meanwhile, Russia and China came to an agreement this week, not involving the U.S., as to how to handle the ICBM that North Korea successfully tested as a gift to the U.S. on Independence Day. The Russian and Chinese agreement would freeze military maneuvers by the U.S. and South Korea in exchange for North Korea's freezing of its nuclear missile program. That agreement got very little attention in the media in the United States because the U.S., while it agreed to the terms of it, was not an active participant in that agreement. And what we're seeing, and we're seeing very much this at the G20 as well, is that as our traditional allies in East Asia and Europe in particular are distanced from the Trump administration, a lot of these different countries and Russia and China as power players as well are discovering that they can do bilateral and multilateral agreements that don't involve the U.S., and the U.S. can be sidelined in a lot of these international conflicts. And that is something I think we're going to see a lot more of in the future as the Trump administration becomes increasingly isolated outside the orbit of the various governments closely allied, as we saw with Poland this week, with the efforts of Vladimir Putin to get his allies elected in Western democracies.
All right. Events.
Coming up this week, tomorrow there will be a March for Justice for Philando Castile. That will be at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine, Sunday night. It's from 6 to 10 p.m. Monday, as we mentioned earlier in the show, there will be the final city council vote on a progressive income tax. That's going to be held at 12:30, so a good stop on your lunch hour by council chambers at City Hall, 5th and James. And then we've got another council hearing, this for King County Council, on Wednesday, July 12th from 3 to 5 p.m. The Regional Policy Committee will be discussing and taking public testimony on a $60 million Veterans, Seniors, and Human Services levy that is coming up. So if you want input on that or to discuss why that might be a necessary piece of our county social safety net for people that are very much left in difficult situations and are disproportionately represented in our homeless population as well, that will be at the King County Council Chambers, 516 3rd Avenue, the King County Administration Building on the 10th floor.
And I just want to remind people that don't forget to use your democracy vouchers to donate up to $100 in public funding to a candidate of your choice in the city of Seattle. They can be used to support candidates for the city council or the city attorney races this year. For more information on the Democracy Voucher Program, to obtain replacement vouchers, or to see a list of candidates, visit www.seattle.gov, that's gov/democracyvoucher, or call 206-727-8855.
What's that number again?
That's 206-727-8855.
And ballots are going to be mailed toward the end of this coming week. And starting next week, we'll be talking about what you might be considering when you vote for those different races.
All right.
And I'll have that up on jov.org as well and Facebook.